You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. This week, we have on Test Kitchen Manager Gabby Melion, who has developed not one, but three empanada recipes for BonAppetit.com. Today, she brought in her ground beef version for me to try as we talked. And after that, my assistant Ryan Walker and food editor at large Carla Lolly Music are back with yet another edition of The Feedbag, wherein we respond to reader letters, comments, and DMs. And last, but certainly not least, we've got Alex Beggs with Cook, Marry, Kill. All right, here is Gabby. Gabby, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm super excited.
You know what I am? I'm super hungry.
I can tell.
I've never been so hungry for a podcast. I'm looking at these like glistening, crispy, golden brown empanadas in the middle of the table, and like, can I get one?
Yeah, of course.
All right.
There are different ones, I can tell you. A couple of these have a little bit of sugar, like my grandmother used to put. My grandmother used to, like, I don't know, she did it for us. So it gives it an extra layer of sweetness. And then I did a couple of people helped me do the repulgue. That's the way you crimp it to show the differences. Sometimes they do that depending on the filling. You know, when you go to the stores, they have different ways of closing them. So you know if it's chicken or if it's beef or if it's cheese or whatever. I should be eating one too. I'm going for it.
I'm eating one, but now I'm talking with my mouth full.
It's all right. That's what I told everyone. Adam wants to chew on the microphone.
I know, and then we're going to get angry commenters.
No. I mean, come on, everyone does it.
Okay, you've done two videos for us.
With empanadas.
One with Brad Leone. Was that your first video ever?
That one was my first time in front of the camera being part of the video. Yes, Brad.
What was that like?
I was very nervous.
You didn't seem nervous, though.
No, I know, but I thought I was going to lose my voice because when I get emotional, I lose my voice and, you know, the height difference, and I was just trying to talk. And
Let's talk about that. So Brad is, I'm going to say, 6'4".
Mm-hmm.
Gabby is what?
5'.
Sure. Are you sure that's a 5?
I say 5'1", and actually my passport says 5'2".
What are you barefoot?
5'5".
Okay.
5. Yeah.
All right.
But I'm shrinking. I'm getting older. I'm shrinking.
We all are, Gabby. But Brad does that thing where he kind of like spreads his legs out and he kind of gets low on the counter.
I love it. Yeah. Because, you know, it can be the same high that way.
Was it easier than you thought it would be in terms of doing it, or?
It was fun. I was, you know, it's hard to follow him and you never know what to expect with him, but it was fun. And I feel like I was able to talk about the empanadas, and people are super excited in Argentina that I actually was representing. So I think it went well.
Did you get comments from people in Argentina?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, from South America in general, all over, especially from Argentina. Some of them were like, oh, well, in my town, we don't make them like this. Because inside Argentina, we have different types of empanadas. We have like the ones from the north, the ones from the south, the center, that's where I'm from, Buenos Aires. So these are called porteñas, because if you are born in Buenos Aires, you are a porteño from the port of Buenos Aires. So, you know, we are very opinionated people.
You? No way.
No. But Argentinians in general, we are like, you know, I do it this way, do it that way. Some people discuss if you need like raisins or not, and some people say, oh, disgusting, it has olives. But for me, a porteña has, you're going for the second one, people.
Oh, yeah.
Yay, Adam Rappaport is having the second one.
These are little empanadas.
I make them kind of a small. Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with the ones on the plate now, which is the first video of you and Brad from his It's Alive series.
Yeah.
This is a ground beef empanada.
Ground beef, typical porteña.
You have raisins in there?
Raisins.
Do these ones have raisins in them?
These have raisins.
Okay.
Olives, green olives, the ground beef, obviously, red peppers, onions, and then you have oregano, cumin, salt, pepper, a tiny bit of sugar, a little bit of paprika for color. That's what it makes all that juiciness. And then I put a hint of cayenne pepper for heat, because I hear people tend to like heat a little more. We're not really into hot food, spicy.
I think it's nice to have a little bit, especially if you have a little sugar just to balance it out.
Yeah.
Okay, so in that first video, what I noticed right away was you made me feel okay about not making my own dough.
Oh, no, totally. I mean, empanadas are probably eaten, let's say, in Buenos Aires, in a typical family, probably, I don't want to say once a week, maybe every other week, but it's something that you get together with friends and you either order out. We have great places that sell empanadas and they deliver. There are some places that they do only empanadas and they have any flavor in the world that you can imagine. And then there are other places that have pizza and empanadas. So you either order or you make your own. So people are like known within their friends for their filling, but you will not find anybody that is going to make baked empanadas making their own dough because it's such a long process and it's not even worth it. By 20 minutes later, everybody ate them. So we have really good store-bought dough that it comes already pre-packed, and we use that. I mean, if someone tells you they're making their own dough, they're lying.
I think there's like this impression, like in Italy, for instance, and there's a ton of Italians in Argentina, that everyone makes their own pasta from scratch every night. And that's just not the case.
No. We have also good, really good pasta places that you go and buy fresh pasta by the kilo. Although we do, and my brother makes the best pizza. Pizza people make at home on Saturday nights.
Okay.
Yeah, the guys make pizza at home Friday night, Saturday night. It's very common. You go to someone's house and they make, you know, their own pizza, their own recipe of the best pizza.
All right, so I want to make empanadas at home. Mm-hmm. What sort of dough should I buy? What should I be using if I'm not making my own?
This one is Goya. And it's
what?
Goya.
Goya, okay. Mm-hmm.
And it's like you can buy it in any supermarket, basically. Actually, when I published my recipe in February of 2017, one of the things that Rick Martinez was helping me with was to fact check, you know, like find out if you can really find this dough everywhere. And it is. It's really easy, available. You can even order it on Amazon.
What sort of dough is it? Is it?
It's called empanada, or, and it says in English, turnovers.
I'm going for number three.
No, I see that. You're watching? Oh, my God.
I told you I was hungry.
I'm so happy. Any Spanish local market, if you live in a neighborhood that there is some sort of Latino community, I'm sure they have it. Goya, though, they have different ones. They have some for frying, and they have Colombian dough that is completely different because it's made with sort of like cornmeal.
Oh, okay, sure.
So it's a completely different dough because those are for frying. So this one is actually, it says for empanadas, for baking, and it comes from Uruguay, actually. The dough comes from Uruguay, and Goya packages here in New Jersey, near my house.
All right, so.
But if you don't have these, you can use any puff pastry and cut it in circles, rounds, and that's it because it's very similar to puff pastry.
So for this one, for the filling, you were browning the ground beef, seasoning it, and then you took out the ground beef from the pot.
And then you put the onions and the peppers. That's one way of doing it. I think when we published the recipe, we did first the onions and then we moved them out. You can either way. For me, it's faster to do the onions in one pot and the meat in another. The reason why I do it that way, because I used to make 300, 400 empanadas every weekend when I was selling them.
Okay, we're going to get to that. First, let's get to this recipe. So you have the ground beef, the onions, the red peppers, the seasoning.
Cumin is your key.
Yep, you can ingredient. Taste that.
And it releases all this juice and makes it sweat. And that's the flavor you're going for.
You cut out rounds with like a pastry cutter or no?
These come already round.
Oh, they come already round.
They come already
Those
round.
Smart people
at Goya.
You don't need
to cut anything. And they come with this little plastic in between so they don't get stuck one with the other.
See, that's what I noticed. I noticed when you took the filling, but first of all, you want to cool the filling, right?
Cool the filling. You can even freeze the filling. My mother used to freeze the filling in portions. And then it's much better because when you're baking it, it releases all that water, all that juice, and they're even better. Yeah.
So you were using like a little like ice cream scoop or something?
Yeah, because I like to measure, you know, I want every empanada to have the same amount. I'm also go so far of not putting the olives until the end. So I work like on a line, like in a restaurant.
Oh yeah. So as I continue to eat more, we're gonna get so many angry letters. But
No.
Yes. So anyways, you've got your filling with the raisins, the onions, this and that, but that you kept the olives separate, the green
olives
that you break in half.
Yeah. And then I make sure every empanada has, that's dedication, sorry, people, I'm saying it myself. I make sure that everybody gets two halves of olive. Because the worst part will be like, if you tell someone, oh, I'm putting olives in my empanada, and then they bite on it, and there is none. So when your filling is done, you can actually don't see anymore where the olives went, you know? So I just carefully put two halves of olive in each empanada before I close them.
So you fold them over with this little round plastic wrap,
yeah,
on the outside.
Me. Yeah, just to help me.
And then you pinch them shut. And then the big question between you and Brad on the video of It's Alive was, do you crimp them with the fork or do you do the fancy thing that you do?
Right. Well, crimping it with the fork makes them look bigger. So here's the secret, people. When I was selling them, I was using the fork, not only because it was faster and I could get somebody to help me, that was my mother, and they look bigger, so you can charge a little
more. Oh, so they, all right.
People don't like when it's too crimp. They feel like they're eating a lot of dough. I love it, personally.
What's the word again?
Repulgue.
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 How are we spelling that?
R-E-P-U-L-G-E. Repulgue.
Oh, repulgue.
You got it.
So it's like you're... It's almost like it looks like a little rope. You're sort of twisting it onto itself. So you have that nice braided exterior, which I think is super pretty.
Yeah, I know. And I can do it really quick. And the story goes like this. Apparently, when I was 8, I don't remember much, but...
I'm going to have a fourth empanada now.
Oh, my God.
These are so small.
I know. They're tiny. They're tiny people. He's not eating, overeating. When I was 8, my grandmother, who could never actually crimp really pretty, she used to do the fork. Because it was faster, you know, you're making 3-4 dozen empanadas. She asked me to help her because I was always in the kitchen with her. And apparently I started twisting the empanada, crimping like that, doing the repulgue. And she almost cried because I was doing it the exact same way her mother did, that she could never learn it well. And I met my great-grandmother when I was 1, and then she died. So she could not possibly taught me that. So I guess it wasn't my... jeans.
crimp them up in the oven.
Yes.
Like, what?
Depending on, I put it like 350, 375. I mean, you gotta know your oven.
Do you do an egg wash on the?
I did
dough?
Egg wash for this one because they look prettier, but you don't have to. Yeah.
So, I love these because you got the onion, you got the ground beef, but I love that touch of sweetness. But then it's balanced with the brininess of the olives. You have the little bit of heat. But then that's balanced with the fruitiness of the raisins.
Right.
And you just kind of keep eating empanada. Do people ever dip empanadas in anything?
Okay. We don't, but here we do. So when I started selling empanadas, people will ask me for a sauce or for something to dip or to pour on.
Because Americans love dip.
I know.
Like ranch dressing. Can I get a side of ranch with that?
Right. So... my mother, who was my best assistant ever, got really upset. She was like, why are they asking you to make something else? And I was like, Mom, I can sell one more thing. And she's like, you're right. So we started selling chimichurri with it, and people went nuts. They will pour a bit of chimichurri. I know in Colombia, for example, they put a little sauce. Some other countries they do, but in Argentina, typically... you will not put anything on the empanada because, you know, they already have all the flavors inside.
All right, so what's up with this empanada business you and your mom had?
I had, well, it was mine. She was my assistant, so.
Wow, mom, getting
served. But I pay her. I mean, no, come on. She was the best. So a few years back, I created a company called Gabby's Kitchen, and my goal was to have like a nomad cooking school and bring free culinary classes for kids in private and, you know, public schools. And that was my idea because I was a Food Revolution ambassador with Jamie Oliver. So, you know, I wanted to teach every child in the world how to cook. It was fun, but I wasn't making any money.
Yeah.
So I was working as a chef assistant, doing a lot of other things.
Where were you living?
In Jersey City, always. I've been 23 years in Jersey City. Yeah. You know, somebody ordered empanadas from me, and I was like, you know what? This can be a business. I went and I paid a very expensive vendor's license. It cost like $400, $500 a year. And I have to rent a kitchen. I was have like a company, and you know, like everything was super legal, and I started selling empanadas. It was mostly to order, but I did a couple of things on the street, fairs, you know, parties. So I cook out of a kitchen in the back of a church that it was licensed to have people cooking there, and I did that for a couple of years, and it was pretty well.
What was your biggest order ever?
Oh gosh, I don't remember. Maybe like 300, 400 mm-hmm. for one person for a party.
Yeah.
I mean, at one point I have an extra freezer, and I have them because also you can like fill them up, crimping them, and then you can freeze them and then just bake them from frozen. I know I have a good friend of mine who owns a company here in New York City called Nuchas, and he sends them to people's homes frozen. And I think they're slightly pre-baked, so it takes a lot less time to put it in the oven, like I think 10 minutes,
yeah.
And they're ready. You know, there's so many people selling empanadas.
But your next video, you're like, I don't need no Brad Leone. I'm going to do my own empanadas video. This one, oh man, I was really hungry watching this one.
Ham, cheese,
and onions.
Yeah.
Now, is this like a classic Argentinian?
Ham and cheese is classic. For me, adding the onions was a little bit of a homage to like the pizza that we like. We love fugazza and fugazzetta, that is onions with cheese. And then if you want to go the extra mile, you throw the ham in there. And I love them. I mean, you need the sweetness of the onions. And also because of the first video and so many people saying, oh, why are you making them bake? We like them fry. And that's another thing.
Oh, wait, we're going to get to that.
People don't fry.
I want to get to that. But first of all, so you caramelize the onions first.
And I put some oregano in it. Oregano, that's a key ingredient.
Get them nice and sweet and caramelly.
Yes, I need that oregano on that. It's very... I have dreams with that flavor. I love it. Onions with oregano. I love it. And then the cheese, that it has to be a mozzarella, but not so soft that it will disappear.
Yeah, you said that you want like the block of low moisture blocks.
Yeah,
you don't want the fancy fresh stuff.
No, because that will disappear. That will
too
melt.
Too watery.
Yeah. And I roll it in cornstarch or a little bit of flour, so that will keep it like together inside the oven.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. After you cut it into cubes and then you dusted it.
Yeah.
And then ham.
Ham has to be like a cheap ham. You don't want like, I mean, if you want to spend money on prosciutto, by all means.
No, listen, you need cheap ham. No, you
said
that in the video. You don't want prosciutto because prosciutto would be too chewy. It would get stuck in your teeth and too salty.
Yeah, but I mean, they're better ham.
But this is a good cooked ham.
Yeah.
Like if it was Italian, it'd be prosciutto cotto.
Prosciutto cotto, the
cooked stuff.
Yeah.
Like if you're making a ham and cheese sandwich,
you want
that ham. And you just chop that up.
Yep.
And I also liked in this one, you had the ham and the onions, which you mixed together, and you kind of scoop that, put it in the round, and then you personally like take two or so cubes of cheese, so you have the exact right amount.
When you work in a line in a restaurant, you understand where I'm coming from. I'm coming from selling them. So when you sell something, you want to be consistent with the amount.
In terms of like what are your food costs?
Right,
and like,
right. So you want to be consistent in the amount of stuff you have. Also, you don't want to... Like I said, you're at a party, somebody bites into it, and it's like, oh, I got no cheese. You know,
yeah, I got a cheese and ham empanada. I wanted a ham and cheese empanada.
Right, totally. I can imagine some people going like that. So you want to make sure that you get the same amount for everyone. You know, you count your cost, you make everyone happy. And, you know, I mean, I'm a little bit of a control freak. I have to make sure that everyone looks the same.
So in this video, you made your own dough.
Mm-hmm.
Was that just to prove to the doubters that you could make your own dough if you wanted to?
Correct.
Because people, the comment section can be brutal.
Oh, my goodness.
I know they love them some Gabby on the Bon Appetit YouTube channel, but in general, people.
But my question.
Especially with any time you do any dish that can be perceived as a quote-unquote authentic dish, everyone's going to let you know.
Of course. They all have their opinion. Yes. And I love it. But the thing is, are these people, are they cooking? Are you cooking at home? I mean, like...
No, they just want to tell you that you're doing it wrong.
Exactly. Like, I live like that. If you don't have something nice to say, don't say anything. That's my, you know, like I go by that rule. But some people want to talk. Okay. So, I also wanted to show that you can make them fry at home. I know a bunch of people and staff had lived in Buenos Aires at one point or another, and they always told me, oh, I like fry empanadas. And, like, you don't really fry at home because you don't want to make all that mess. You do it like an special occasion.
Yeah, we, you know, we've done articles like in Bon Appetit and stuff for frito misto and, you know, like other deep fried sort of things. And it's not that it's hard to do, but if you don't have a really powerful hood over your stove, so which is 90% of most New York City kitchens don't, then you're opening the windows, you got a fan on, your apartment still smells
like oil
a week later.
Yeah.
And then you're also, what I do with all this oil that I just deep fried in.
Right.
Fortunately, we work in a fancy industrial kitchen here.
So they pick it up for us, yes.
But it does it, I mean, it kind of tastes better.
It tastes better. It's so worth it. I will say do it for a special occasion, you know, like a birthday party or you want to celebrate something. But going back to in Buenos Aires, people will do it, but also like in a special occasion. In the north of Argentina, I will say people fry more often. Yeah. But I'm saying people that have larger kitchens with windows and, you know, they don't have all the problems we have here in Buenos Aires, apartments in New York. The apartments are so tiny, you can't do it. But, I mean, if you have the patience for it, go for it.
Carla was saying in our New Year's Eve podcast that she likes to do, she's throwing a fancy party. She'll do like a moment where she is frying like maitake mushrooms, as if she's like Jamie Oliver or someone, like having this moment, like this performance moment
where people gather
around and she's got the spider things and she's pulling it out and doing this and that, which is kind of cool.
But she has the kitchen for it because she has a kitchen with a window.
Got to be open and stuff. But yeah, it's nice. That's the thing with deep frying, that you can't walk away from it. You're you're on duty.
Mm-hmm.
So deep fried ham and cheese, delicious.
You gotta eat them right away.
Right. Oh, that, yeah, you want them nice and crispy.
Yeah, you wanna eat them right away. So then, it's, you know, the person who's frying is like frying, and every time you put a plate out, comes back empty, and you keep, you know, like.
It's like if you've ever had a Hanukkah latke party. If you're on latke duty, you're on latke
duty.
You got
duty. It.
That's it.
Or pancakes on a Sunday.
Pancakes, or
eggs to order.
It's a lonely job being a cook.
Yes, of course.
These were delicious. Thank you for the empanadas. I think four is my limit.
Okay,
I'm going to say enough.
Enough.
But those were delicious. Thanks so much, Gabby.
No, thank you for having me.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Carla Music, welcome back to The Feedbag.
Always happy to be here.
And we got Ryan Walker on the mic, as always, reading our letters and emails and DMs and all those other great things we get from our fans and readers and listeners. It's not that funny.
Yes, I'm here. I'm excited. Let's do this.
All right, what do you got, Ryan?
Alrighty. So first up, we have a comment from our lovely inbox. I just listened to the podcast. I'm already dangerously close to canceling my subscription because the font is too small to read. But if you go through with having 30% less recipes with meat, I will 100% not renew my subscription.
Can I ask a question? Because there's such an intense segue in the way that the comment is set up, because it's like it's a font size problem. But then I will just want to know, if he goes through with the canceling of the subscription, will he continue to listen to the podcast?
I hope so. Yeah, because we need the podcast listeners actually more than we need the 1.5 million subscribers.
So you could stay digital and enlarge your font and keep listening. Yeah.
Okay, so obviously two issues here. The first is the 30% less meat, which is somewhat factually incorrect, but that he's referring to the podcast that Chris Morocco and I did about this new test kitchen mandate, about how we're going to run a more efficient, environmentally sensitive test kitchen moving forward. But before we get to that, I do want to side with the complaint about small font size, or type size, actually. Font is like the what the lettering looks like. Type size is what the size is. For whatever reason, designers from Alex Grossman to Michelle Outland to Chris Cristiano, they love tiny type.
You gotta fit it all on the page.
But they don't love tiny type. They love the absence of type.
Yeah, that's true. They want to make the words as small as possible so there's more. Also, I don't know. Listen, I'm a pretty design-minded editor, but it's like, did you read the words? Because if you want people to read the words, you have to make them big enough that people can actually read them.
They don't want them to read the words. They're like, remember when I pitched the no word issue at one of our retreats?
I do. No, I actually like that. Can you,
Yeah,
pitch
just
again?
Like in all, it was at one of our retreats, like pitch anything, like pies in the sky or whatever.
It was an ideas meeting.
Yeah. And it was like, why don't we just do a whole issue without words?
Could you have symbols?
Sure, but like small.
So anyway, so God bless our design team. I love those guys. But yeah, even go back to my years at GQ, it's just the type has always been tiny. And that's just an ongoing battle between editors and designers. So we hear you and we feel you. Now, getting to the line in our sort of sustainability statement that is online that you can see on bonapetit.com about how the test kitchen will be running a little differently moving forward. What we said was, from here on out, 30% of the recipes we develop will be meatless.
Correct.
And I guess, Carlo, to put that into context, how does that skew compared to how we had been running things? And what's your take on that approach?
I think that at the end of the day, what that's going to mean is that twice as many recipes will be plant-based. I think probably currently we run maybe, out of every 100 recipes, 10 of them are meat-free. So
yeah, Chris said maybe 10-15%.
Yeah, 10-15%.
And so, that is, to be clear, that is not counting, but that's not counting desserts.
Correct.
Yeah, dessert recipes are in their own category. We're not talking chocolate covered bacon.
Right. and we're excluding dessert from that to give us like a truer, percentage, because it wouldn't be fair to include like dessert recipes, which are by nature going to probably be vegetarian. So what I think that means is that, you'll still be able to go to bonappetit.com and pull up a steak, chicken, pork, meat, shrimp, fish recipe that we've published over the last many, many decades. It just means that going forward, we are not going to develop as many new recipes with animals.
Yeah. And I think, 30% in the big scheme of things, that still means 70%
correct
of the recipes can have
yes,
meat,
right?
Which I still think we could probably chip away at that, but still, that's plenty of meaty recipes to choose
around
from. I think if you look at the sites, I'm just looking at Healthy-ish right now, which is one of the Bon Appetit verticals, roasted fall vegetables with herb salad, or Orecchiette with spinach and rosemary fried chickpeas. Just the other day, Andy Bergani was testing this delicious pasta fagioli sort of recipe with canned chickpeas that is cooked in a tomato broth with pasta, and some of the chickpeas are pureed, and there's Parmesan cheese and olive oil, and it's like the most indulgent, exactly, homey comfort food.
Yeah.
When you're eating things like that, you're not like, oh, this is healthy, or this doesn't have meat in it. You're like, no, this is delicious.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking about it. I'm forgetting meat.
I know, exactly. Like, the notion, when one of us is eating mac and cheese, you're not like, oh,
I wish this had bacon in it.
Yeah,
right.
But some people like bacon in their mac and cheese.
That drives me crazy, actually. That whole restaurant trend from 10 years ago when they're like, I don't want foie gras in my mac and cheese. I don't want lobster in my mac and cheese. I just want mac and cheese.
I hear that.
Also, what's actually interesting, I don't know if you knew this, Carla, maybe I'm announcing news here, but over at Epicurious, which is our sister brand here at Condé Nast, moving forward, they will not be developing any recipes using beef.
I know. Yeah. I had been talking to David about this for a few months before it went into effect. And, similarly, I think what it means is right now in this moment, we want to consume less of that product. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that they're going to strip away every steak recipe that was ever published on Epi. So you kind of have the benefit of, still providing content for people who are looking for it, but making a choice in this day and age, just for us to buy less and use less and develop fewer recipes is very impactful. We cook through most recipes 3 or 4 times before we publish them. So it's a lot.
Yeah, and I would say just to put Epi, just to give some insight into how Epi is run, they develop their own recipes, but they also carry every Bon Appetit recipe that's ever been published.
Right.
So you can still go on to Epi, you can get every steak recipe.
And gourmet.
Yeah, and gourmet, every braised short rib recipe you want. So like I said, I don't see these sort of changes as being drastic or abstaining from something. It's more like let's evolve and let's sort of get a little bit more in step with how people are eating these days and compared to how they might have done 20 years ago.
Yeah.
All right, Rye.
Next letter. I have a suggestion that's been on my mind for some time. A great way to be more sustainable is to steer customers away from buying BA product recommendations on Amazon. It's well known as a company that doesn't put its money where its mouth is when it comes to sustainability. Right after finding this email in my inbox, I saw that BA's Instagram story was featuring the 2019 Top Test Kitchen Accessories article, which includes 21 products, all of which were linked on Amazon. I've frequently seen suggestions to find products on Amazon featured in the magazine as well. So many of these products, most of them, can be bought directly from the makers, some of which are smaller, lesser-known companies that deserve the benefits of the exposure BA can give them.
This is a tough one.
I don't disagree.
Okay. I know I've struggled with this too.
Yeah, I think we all struggle. A great, great letter. Thank you very much. So Bon Appetit, along with nearly every media brand these days, from The Strategist on down, recommends products editorially, but anything that is bought of stuff that is recommended, the brand, be it Bon Appetit or whomever, gets a percentage of sale. So, and if you look at any Bon Appetit article that is endorsing a product, it'll say at the top or the bottom, all products featured on bonappetit.com are independently selected by their editors. However, when you buy something through our retail links, we may earn an affiliate commission.
Yeah.
So
that means that it's not like a placed thing and it's not really an advertisement. These are things that we use, we love, we would recommend regardless.
You know, affiliate revenue is one way editorial brands are sort of shoring up their P&L in these days of shrinking advertising.
Right.
So you're making far less money through banner ads and stuff on site. Well, how do you make up for that? All right, well, we're going to sell some products. Then the question is, well, who do you link to?
Right.
And I think we can all relate to, I think all of us have bemoaned and sort of badmouthed Amazon as this corporate giant who's putting small businesses out of business. I personally don't have an Amazon account.
Good for you.
I've never ordered anything on Amazon. I believe in giving the little guys much more of a chance. That's how I like to shop. However, and I think I'm like a lot of people, I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth because my wife has an Amazon Prime thing, and Lord knows she's bought stuff for the family on Amazon.
Right.
So I'm like, okay, on one hand, I don't want to support it. On the other hand, I do. Oh, and Whole Foods, which is a whole other thing, because Amazon owns Whole Foods, which we constantly endorse.
Yes.
So, and Carl, where do you fall in the Amazon relationship personally?
Similar household organization. I have an Amazon account and I've had one for a long time. And my husband does not, but he uses my login. And that's how I find out that, like, he bought blackout shades and, you know, plungers, and I get the email.
What kind of operation are you running over there, Carla? Jeez.
I have tried to order less often from Amazon, and this Christmas we actually made I initiated like, let's not buy any Christmas presents on Amazon. Like when the kids were little, I mean, 100% leaned into
that. We got something the other day. I forget what it was. A box showed up, a box the size of like a shoebox. Open it up. There's those inflatable pillows in there. Whatever the object was, I forget what it was like the size of like a bottle of aspirin. You're like, oh, God.
I know. So, but I think in the other part of this is like what there have been some articles about in cities like New York, how much the truck traffic is changing the way that our city like runs.
Interesting.
And it's massive because there's like same day delivery and like.
Well, I see that now with like you can get your groceries for free in 2 hours. I'm like, how is that possible?
Yeah,
wrong.
It's a lot.
Right?
I mean, and Target does that too. Their same day delivery where they just like, you know, basically are just dispatching somebody as soon as your thing is put together. It's
a lot of the system. Anything that we want as consumers for super cheap and fast means probably someone's getting underpaid.
Yes.
And the environment's not well treated. It's a problem. So people say they want other options.
Yeah.
And yet what people end up doing is on their own volition end up click into Amazon because I think they have a relationship with Amazon. They know it's going to come. They know it's going to come quickly.
They have an account already.
Yeah, they have an account, they're, and there's an ease.
And while they're there, they might pick up some, you
it's
know,
convenient.
Probiotics
or a plunger.
You just never know.
So I think that's, but that's just the, I think the world we're in now with like everything from Uber to this or that to like cheap clothes at Uniqlo. It's like we want it fast and easy and affordable, but you have to think of the repercussions of that also.
I think the workaround. So it's beneficial for us at Bon Appetit because we need to find these additional like alternate revenue streams, right? So that's why we have a relationship with this company that is sharing in some percentage of the shopping cart that you go build when you see the Y peeler that we recommend.
I love a Y peeler. If
I just bought a few the other day.
If you don't peel your vegetables with Y peelers, go to bonappetit.com. Actually, go to Google and search bonappetit.com Y peeler, because if you go to bonappetit.com and search, you'll never find anything. Sorry. If any tech people at Kind of Nash are listening, please fix
that.
I was going to say, you can also trust the advice that we're giving is actually about that product. And if you don't want to buy from Amazon, just look at the product description and buy it wherever you
want. Yeah. Absolutely. And I will say this. So Ella Hay brought the point. Like, yes, a lot of Amazon on there. We do link to other sites, whether it's Cruze or, you know, Williams-Sonoma, et cetera, depending on what the product is. She was also saying other Condé Nast brands have started to give you an option. Mm. They'll give you Amazon plus a link to either another store or to the maker who does it directly. Mm. The challenge is sometimes we have relationships or sometimes we don't have affiliate relationships with those brands, which we then have to initiate and jump through hoops and stuff. But I think it's a great letter. It's an interesting point, and I think it's something we all sort of deal with on a daily basis in terms of how we consume.
But now you know why we have that Amazon link.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Rye, what else we got?
All righty. So on the subject of marijuana, which is a topic that we continue to cover here at Bon Appetit, we have a few letters to Adam. I've chosen one.
And this was from our February Healthiest issue, which we had a spread about sort of how to shop a dispensary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Without freaking out, I think the headline was.
Without freaking out, yes.
Without harshing your mellow.
Right. You're real easy. You're an easy customer.
All right. Dear Mr. Rappaport, I'm very disappointed that Bon Appetit chose to run an article about marijuana edibles. Shop for weed without freaking out in our February 2020 issue. Marijuana possession, sale, use is a federal crime and a crime in many U.S. states. It is difficult to guide my preteen children in making thoughtful decisions about their own possible future marijuana use when mainstream publications treat this often illegal situation as though it is the norm. As you can easily guess, I have canceled my subscription and will no longer have Bon Appetit in my home. I wish you and the editorial staff would have yourself made thoughtful decisions before running that article.
Okay.
Can I read your response?
We'll just talk this out. I know you guys all have thoughts. I know you have thoughts, Ryan. Carla, I imagine you have thoughts.
Because I think your email response was
great. Yeah, I'll just talk it out. Thank you. But yeah, all right, so a couple thoughts here. The first one, as a parent, like, I have a 12-year-old. What ages are you right now?
Sweet 16 and 10.
Yeah, and you live in New York City, so this is very relatable. I mean, I'm on walking on 21st Street at 8 a.m. seeing like 14-year-old kids walk into school smoking weed.
Oh, yeah.
14?
Yeah.
Sure.
And it's just like, dude, like, what are you doing? And it's like, so I get it. And like, you don't see 14-year-old kids like doing shots before school. But like, kids will get some, and that's been going on for a long time. So it is like obviously a concern, and nowadays with vape pens and everything else, like, it's easier than ever. So as a parent, I can totally relate to it. I guess my feeling is, A, we covered a dispensary in states where that's legal, California, right. Colorado, Oregon. And B, I think the big issue here is that Bon Appetit is a magazine for adults. You know, our average reader is age 49, I think, et cetera, et cetera. We cover alcohol, we cover cocktails, wine. I don't know if there is that much of a difference between writing about an edible or a controlled sale of marijuana as there is writing about martinis and how to mix a perfect Manhattan. Mm-hmm,
right.
I don't know, Carl, what do you, as a grown woman, what do you think about in terms of a recreational standpoint?
Yeah, I think that is a really healthy distinction to make. I think that alcohol use is normalized because it's been around longer and is legal everywhere. It wasn't that long ago that there was like prohibition, but every one of us grew up in a household where the alcohol wasn't kept under lock and key. And you knew as a child that like that was for grownups. I think if your underage kid walks into a dispensary, they're not going to be sold to either. It's not like going into a bodega trying to get a six pack.
They can't go in.
But you're right. The reality is that many states now have passed recreational marijuana laws, and it's not a crime there. So if you live there, or if you're curious about this trend, that article is going to kind of be of interest. I don't think we advocated that anyone like should go check it out tomorrow.
I think that gets lost, but we're not saying you need to go get yourself some gummies. I think it's more like, hey, if you're curious about these dispensaries, which frankly look like Apple stores these days,
right.
They're so like beautiful with these little vitrines and beautiful lighting, and you're like, what's going on here?
Right. And if you're curious about what our editor's take is on it, then like, you know, that's a fun read. There's also, you know, CBD and the seltzer. I mean, yeah, I think if anything, if it leads to a conversation between you and your kid about like, hey, did you see that dispensary article? Pretty crazy stuff, right? Like, you know the rules.
Or also, if you're, the reality is if you live in LA, if you live in Portland, Oregon, and if you have a 16-year-old son or daughter, they've gone by those dispensaries before.
Right.
They're curious about them. CBD is everywhere. Like, this is something that's happening in the culture, in the zeitgeist.
Right.
To
yeah.
ignore it, to suggest it's not happening,
right?
I think is incredibly naive.
I think if we wrote an article that was like, how to fake your ID so you can get into a recreational dispensary, that would be crossing the line.
Yeah. And one other thing I wanted to mention is in this letter, she says, we are treating this often illegal situation as though it is the norm, like you were just talking about. The truth is, it is already the norm in so many places. So to ignore that, we wouldn't be doing ourselves any favors.
Right.
And also, as a brand, it's not the first time we have covered this topic. In April 2019, Healthy-ish published a piece that acknowledges exactly that. We published an article written by Charlotte Palermino, and she said, for decades, the media, politicians, and our schools have spread misinformation about what cannabis is and what it does, including that weed is a gateway drug. It's not. That if you smoke weed, you'll go to jail. Those chances are pretty low if you're white. And that marijuana causes instant addiction. The research shows that while cannabis can be addictive, tobacco and alcohol are more deadly and addictive, relatively speaking, which is what Adam also spoke about in his email. And so as a brand and having this conversation, we're joining a larger conversation and trying to combat that misinformation by putting smart, thoughtful, and researched, useful information out there so that people can be informed about something that is, again, already incredibly prevalent.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And listen, there's a long history of marijuana being very criminalized way disproportionately in the Black communities and the white communities. White kids smoke marijuana and they get in trouble. Black kids smoke marijuana and they end up in jail.
Mm-hmm. And even today with the legalization of marijuana, Black and brown folks who want to open dispensaries can't because mm-hmm. they are facing, you know, old charges for nonviolent crimes and also are having a harder time getting grants to start. Like, there's all these other structural problems within the legalization too that makes it so complicated. And I like that we're talking about that.
I think the conversation needs to happen, needs to be transparent, and like it's something that it's happening. And you might disagree with the legalization of marijuana, and that's fine. But the fact is, in these states, it's happening. The dispensaries are opening.
Yep.
It's something you should be educated on and you should be know what's going on. So that is my thoughts on that. One more topic I want to discuss, not from the BA archives, but a piece that Pete Wells recently wrote for the New York Times about noisy restaurants.
Yes.
It was a lengthy piece, but, you know, a diner of a certain age.
Yeah.
Maybe we notice this more. I don't know. I was curious what your take on the piece was.
It was long, but I got through it. And I don't know. I thought that there was a certain amount of nostalgia in Pete's take on the noisiness. Like, by the end of the piece, you can tell, like, he loves going into a restaurant that feels lively and loud and music and conversation, and that there's this moment when we're not kind of all sitting with our noise canceling headphones or walking down the street listening to a podcast and or being in your air conditioned car with the windows rolled up. And like we're all kind of in our own little bubbles these days, that to go into a loud and lively restaurant to him feels like connection. I understand that. And like the right vibe in a restaurant when you do feel that is so fun. But I think I, for me, when someone says noisy restaurant, I'm thinking about like where you're literally screaming at the person at the other side of the table to be heard and to hear them. And I find that kind of restaurant experience in like literally intolerable. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it is maybe that I maybe don't hear as well as I used to. I'm unaware of any. I've had a hearing test recently. Like, I'm unaware of any, like, degradation in...
You might just be crankier than you were 20 years
There's
ago.
There's that. But I, like, I get a certain kind of earache, yeah, like, from a really loud restaurant. It, like, hurts in, like, the TMJ part of my jaw. And I just can't... I can't do it. Yeah. It takes the pleasure out of dining.
I think, to Pete's point, like, there is something about walking in a restaurant, and in New York City, Balthazar is, like, the quintessential example of a restaurant that just feels alive. It, yeah, feels pulsating. You feel like I've stepped into this community, and it's just, I'm feeding off of it. But a restaurant like Balthazar also has really good acoustics.
Right.
And there's a hum and there's a vibrancy to it. That's different than a restaurant. And I've been to a lot of these where I feel the same as you, where they don't have good acoustics. There's no soundproofing on the ceiling or under the tables. The music is maybe only in two speakers, whereas it should probably have like eight speakers, right, that are more evenly modulated. And it's like this cacophonous din.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of that comes down to, it does cost a lot to get good acoustics in most spaces. Mm-hmm. And I talked about with Riyad and Lee from Franchette about this when they were on the pod several months ago. You know, they spent several million dollars to open Franchette, which is a bistro down here in Tribeca, and they did not get around to soundproofing the place, or sound, I don't know if it's called soundproofing, whatever, properly sounding it. And not until it was open for a while did they realize, like, oh, this place is really loud.
So loud.
And like, I love that restaurant, but they're going to have to like shut it down for a couple of days, spend a lot of money. Wow. And then all of a sudden you're dealing with that. And I, Pete also brings to the point, like, I'm guilty of this. Like, I'm the loud person at a restaurant. I've been shushed at numerous examples. One time I got the Bar and Grill years ago, me and Mitchell Davis. Someone shushed us and moved their table away from us. My buddy John Von Soten and I in Paris were shushed at a Paris bistro.
Amazing.
And then one time we were at Ultra Paradiso.
Roast Yourself Wednesday.
For some BA thing. Dinner. And we literally had to buy a bottle of wine for the table behind us.
Just ruin their night.
mostly me were being just way too loud. So I get it. And Pete's point is that if one person's talking loud, then another person is, right, another person, it escalates.
I once saw the most amazing thing in a restaurant that I'll never forget. It was a couple. They were probably in their 50s. It was a kind of loud restaurant. And they were sitting across from each other at a two-top, having a perfectly nice time. And at a certain point, I noticed they both had their iPhones up to their ears.
And they were talking to each other.
That is how they were talking to each other.
Oh my God.
Because of the amazing noise canceling. Like, it blocks all that stuff out. So that was, they were at a restaurant they loved, it with a vibe they loved, food they loved, and the way that they figured out how to hear each other.
Stop.
They were just on the phone the whole time. And I was like, wow.
Another edition of the feedback. This was fun.
It was always.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks, Adam.
Thank you, Carla.
Thank you.
And you can email us with any questions or comments at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com.
Email us.
Hi, this is Alex Beggs, and here's Cook, Marry, Kill. Cook. For lunch this week, I've packed sweet potato bowls because I'm a glowing picture of health. I use Anna Stockwell's recipe as inspiration, which you can look up on BA.com. It's called Sweet Potato Bowls with Spiced Lamb and Mushrooms. I roasted a handful of sweet potatoes before work this morning, and then I'll top them with whatever I've got hanging around, which is leftover Super Bowl fajita steak, the remnants of last week's batch of beans, or just butter and a ton of flaky salt. Or how about some Trader Joe's soy chorizo? Which brings me to Mary. I want to marry Trader Joe's soy chorizo. I know I'm late to the game here and it's been around for a while, but I tried it for the first time when I ranked all the imitation meats at Trader Joe's for healthy-ish, and I really liked it. Imagine regular chorizo, but the beads of meat are finer and crumblier. Everything else is the same. Joe was heavy-handed with the spices here for once, and it covers up any hint that this is a flavorless soy product. It's so good with eggs and breakfast tacos. I actually plan on buying it again. Not so much those meatless meatballs, which were weirdly bready and could possibly be used to stuff couch cushions, you know, in a pinch. You can read about the rest in a story called All the Meat Substitutes at Trader Joe's Ranked. Kill! The whole Mr. Peanut dying, not dying, dying, coming back from the dead, being smashed into peanut butter, baby nut, Super Bowl, convoluted million-dollar ad campaigns. I don't even have the energy to read an article that explains the whole thing. But then, this week, the FDA approved a drug that treats allergic reactions in kids caused by peanut consumption. Coincidence? Did the FDA implanters plan this? To promote peanuts and prepare just in case kids can't resist the baby nut and eat some peanuts they're allergic to? Is this how Alex Jones lives every day of his life? Kill bad publicity stunts.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced and edited by Emma Wortsman, with additional programming help from Carrie Polis and Elise Inamine. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to reach out to us about this episode or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.